Welcome, folks. My name's Arnie Hackett. We have Alfred Christensen here, who is the Release 11 Chief Designer. He's going to take us through the ZOS V1R11 Communication Server Overview. Today's session is being recorded. With that, I'd like to hand the session over to Alfred.
This is Alfred. I'm going to take you through this communication server, ZOS Release 11 content during this one-hour session we have here. With me in the room, I've also got Dave Herr, who is one of the two chief programmers for Release 11, and we've got Michael Gerlach, who's not here, but he's also one of the chief programmers, so you can use any of the three of us also for detailed questions. Now, generally about page two, I'm not going to talk too much about trademarks and things like that, but I do want to point out one of the last paragraphs in this in the small print, because we are this time kind of sticking our head a little bit out in terms of providing you with some very early performance data for some of the line items. So just keep in mind that performance data at this point in time obviously is quite early, and you know, all the normal disclaimers around that. But we thought some of the data was so interesting, we did want to include it here in the session. Also remember, ZOS Release 11 is currently planned to be generally available September this year, so there's going to be a couple of months before you can actually begin working with it, obviously. Normally what we do when we come up with the contents of a release is that we define a series of headlines, if you will. We call them release themes, and the agenda is structured based on those release themes. So we will talk through things we have done within the application areas. We'll talk about availability, scalability, security. We'll talk about things we're doing to try and make life easier for you installing and using the communication server. We've got a couple of SNA items, and we've also got some virtualization and system management items in this release. A relatively large release in terms of content. There's quite a few items in this release that we hope will have your interest, obviously. From an introductional point of view, I just want to kind of point your attention to where does the content in the release actually come from. And just very high level, there are four different types of sources we use when we define the content. The most important, obviously, is the customer input, which we get, or through various forms of requirement channels that come into our organization. We have also some partners within IBM, Software Group, DB2, Web Application Server, Kix, what have you. Almost in every release have some specific requirements they want communication server support for. So that's another source of input to release, and you will actually see some of the enhancements in this release coming from that group. Finally, we have the hardware. We've got ZOS. If a new OSA adapter is being implemented or some new functions in the microcode is being implemented, obviously there has to be some communication server support for that also. That's another group. And finally, the last group down in the left corner is a group we call standards bodies. That is an area we cannot negotiate. When the standards are being updated, ZOS obviously need to comply in order to be able to continue playing in an open environment. So as you can see there, you may think there's really only customer input that governs what we're putting into a release, but there are other items also, other areas also that feed in, and some of those, as we mentioned here, we really don't control the priorities. We just have to do whatever those sources tell us to do. Okay, I'm going to start and look at the application integration, data consolidation, and standards theme here in Release 11. And if we move to page number 7, the first item I want to talk a little about is a new standard application, which is an SMTP client. It is meant to allow you to replace SMTP NJE, the old SMTP gateway, when sending mail from your Jest spool and out into the Internet. It is meant to be, we have to implement it in such a way that it is compatible from a user interface with the old SMTP NJE. Whatever applications you may have today that are writing to the Jest spool with the proper syntax that is today being used by SMTP NJE will be picked up or can be picked up by this new client and sent out into the Internet instead of using the old SMTP NJE server. If you continue to need to receive mail into TSO users by means of the TSO receive command, from the internet, then you have to continue to run SMTP NJE gateway for that purpose. They can run side by side so that you can reduce the amount of work SMTP NJE is doing and replace it with this new CS-SMTP application for sending mail from ZWS. It's significantly more efficient than SMTP NJE was. It does not store notes on temporary sequential data sets and things like that. So it's a much more efficient implementation. It also picks up support for a range of newer functions, including eSMTP, including IPv6 and SSL TLS communication with the mail transfer agents in the network. So we think this is going to be something most of you who currently use SMTP NJE will pick up if you are sending mail from ZWS, and I think that is the majority of the use of SMTP NJE we see today. If you move to page number 8, another area we are improving is FTP. We have quite a few scenarios where both other IBM subsystems and also individual customer applications either pre-process or post-process data that is transferred in or out of ZOS by means of FTP. Currently, such topologies will work as the left side indicates here, that you have the distributed data, you transfer it to ZOS, and you store it then in some temporary intermediate file or MBS data set, and then you run your post-processing utility, in this example, the GB2 batch load utility, for example. This support adds the capability for FTP to read and write directly into a so-called Unix-named pipe, which is really a stream, if you will. That allows an application to send data to another application. And that allows for a topology, as shown on the right, that distributed data is sent by the distributed FTP client to the ZOS FTP server, but then writes it onto a Unix-named pipe that at the same time is being read by the GB2 batch load utility, or in other words, you have an unbroken stream of data from the remote platform straight into the GB2 batch load utility. This is something you can use yourself. SAP on GB2 fast load conversion utility is picking this up. This is actually the main request of this function, and that will be picked up immediately by that utility. But this actually does open up for you writing some relatively interesting pre-post-processing applications around FTP transfers. Page number 9 talks a little bit about supporting hardware and new DAS technology. Some of the newest hardware technology, the DS8000, provides support for what is called extended address volumes, which are volumes that have more than 64K cylinders. And some of the older ones among you remember the CC88R addressing technology kind of breaks down if you have more than 64,000 cylinders. So there's a new infrastructure in place to deal with data sets with volumes of that size. And FTP will, in this release, pick up the capability to read and write to such extended address volume data sets. DFSMS has added BSAM support in release 10. It didn't really impact FTP because FTP, as you know, does not support BSAM. But here in release 11, DFSMS support or adds support for what is known as extended format sequential data sets, and those can be read by FTP. So that's where we pick up this support. Now, that support did have one additional change or consequence, and many of you probably don't even know that, but there's a site command called QDisk, which will show the different volumes that are online to the system and also will show the size of the volumes. Obviously, with these very large volumes, we needed to change the layout of the response from that QDisk command. So just be aware, if you did have any automation that screen scraped the QDisk output, you will have to go and look at that. I don't think it's very likely that any of you would have done that, but just you will have to look at it if you did do something like that. Okay? Next application area that we looked into was actually an area which we have provided numerous solutions to over the last many years, And it's the old story about the Telnet server coming in and the user logging on to TSO, and something happens in the TCP network and we lose the connection. Well, if the TSO SNA session remained up, you could not reconnect to it because TSO wouldn't do that unless we had had an abnormal end of that session before. So in release 11, there's a joint effort between the TSO team in Poughkeepsie and the Telnet server team down here in Raleigh that implements a new option in IKJ TSO member, IKJ TSO member. That's called log on here, and it can either be on or off. And what it means if you set it on is that if you try to connect a Telnet client in and connect and establish a session to TSO, and TSO says, well, I already have a session, SNA session for that user, then instead of rejecting the reconnect, TSO will, under the covers, drive its own loss term exit, allowing that new connection to actually be established, which basically means that your reconnect is going to work in just about all the scenarios normally would want it to work in. This option in IKJ TSO will, in release 11, ship with the default value on, so you need to make sure that you're aware of that. We don't really see any issues with it. Just be aware that suddenly reconnects might actually work in scenarios where you didn't expect them to work or they hadn't worked before. We think that's going to be a good thing to observe. Page 11 is an overview over common storage constraint relief by the Telnet server. We have worked on that since ZOS release 7, and we run in every release a regression test workload where we have a ZOS LPAR with 256,000 Telnet connections. That's a huge workload, as you can imagine. That workload actually then you connect into this LPAR with the Telnet server is, and then we use Enterprise Extender from that LPAR and go out over one gigabyte Ethernet internet network to another ZOS LPAR where the SNA application is then running. So this is a really hefty workload, as you might imagine. Initially in release 7, that required around 800 megabytes of ECSA storage. And we have that now down to around 350 megabytes, which is a really good improvement, obviously. And so if you are having large Telnet server configurations, you should expect to see some good gains there in that area. Page 12, IP version 6 continues to, you know, loom out there on the horizon. The various internet numbering authorities now keep a daily track of when IPv4 addresses will run out, and the current prediction is that the IANA, which kind of manages the worldwide IPv4 address space, will run out of blocks around 2011, which basically means at that point in time they can't assign a block of IPv4 addresses to the regional registries. Now, the regional registries will still have some IP addresses left, but they are predicted to run out around September 2012. So around 2012, late 2012, it will likely not be possible to go to the regional registry and say, oh, I need another block of public IPv4 addresses to support a new NAT firewall I want to install between my intranet and the public internet. So this is coming closer, is my point, and we do need to begin thinking about it. And I know some of you have already thought about it, some of you have done testing with IPv6, but many of you have not done that yet. So I just want to raise a little reminder here. This is becoming something you do need to worry about. Page 13 is just the overview of where we are at this point in time. Release 11 does a couple of things in this area, not a terrible lot. The new SMTP client is IPv6 enabled from the start. And we do some RFC updates that were required by some of the compliance listings we go through. Page number 14 just gives you an overview where ZOS currently is in terms of IPv6 certifications. Release 5 was IPv6 ready phase 1 local certified, and release 8 was phase 2 certified. And ZOS release 10 has just been certified by the Department of Defense here in the U.S., basically says that ZOS release 10 meets the requirements for IPv6 compliance that are being defined by the Department of Defense in the U.S. So those are kind of the milestones from a compliance testing point of view. I'm not going to go into more details about IPv6 in this session here because it doesn't have the interest of that many of you at this point in time. We're going to continue into availability and business resilience area. It's all everything to do with keeping the system up and running, obviously. Page 16 shows a kind of set of initiatives we are putting into release 11, which aim at better dealing with storage shortage conditions. Some of you have in the past seen scenarios where OMP route was not able to get the storage it needed to send out its periodic hello packets. After about 40 seconds, the neighboring routers basically say, well, this ZOS system is no longer reachable, and deletes all routes to that ZOS system. So what might have started out as kind of a bad storage constraint situation that might have been solved by waiting a little bit longer kind of ends up in almost a disaster because suddenly the whole ZOS system cannot be reached by the network any longer. So this line item addresses those conditions, and it does it in different ways. It does it by having some internal measurements that says, oh, we are now in a storage constrained scenario. And when that occurs, various mechanisms will kick in that will try to limit the amount of resources we will use to process inbound data over the OSA Express adapters. And we may eventually begin dropping some packets at the DLC layer. Not to stress the system any further, which is okay in an IP environment. Just means that some TCP layer is going to retransmit a little bit later. Now, a reason why we might get into a storage constrained situation is often applications that for some reason stall. Think about a server address space that has, let's say, 500 TCP connections that are all connected and are receiving data from clients, and for some reason the whole address space comes to some kind of a screeching halt. Well, the TCP layer will continue to receive inbound data and store it in the receive buffers until the receive buffers are filled. But if you had 500 connections and the receive buffers were 180K, that's a lot of storage you're burning there just keeping track of all that data. So the same thing when we are sending data, we will store the data in the send buffers, obviously, until the receiving application in the network can take the data. So some hiccups in the application area can cause TCP/IP to use an excessive amount of storage to basically keep track of all the data that right now is in flight. So what this release will do, when something like that occurs, it will actually provide alerts to you. There will be alerts written through the TRMD and the syslogd infrastructure that this specific application was now in this condition. And we will also begin looking at the buffers that we are maintaining and try and mark some of them as pageable. They will generally be fixed because they have to be ready to actually be sent out through some kind of an IO operation. So we'll go through and we will mark them pageable, try to relieve the stress on stores at that point in time. So a lot of different things in this area to improve that scenario. And in addition to that, OMP route itself gets some enhancements here that should allow it to just about always get the storage it needs, even if we are totally stressed on storage. OMP route should still be able to get the storage it needs in this scenario here. So a lot of good stuff that probably, hopefully, is going to make sure that the systems are going to stay up in those type of scenarios, even though it may not be caused by TCP/IP, but that's the world we live in. Page number 17, Sysplex Distributor and Workload Manager is improving the algorithms that are used for determining where new workloads should go. This is a bit techy. I'm not going to go through all the details. I'm just going to give you some highlights what it does. Generally, when Sysplex Distributor asks Workload Manager, which LPaaS can I send some new workload to at some importance level, Workload Manager will then basically look at those LPaaS and say, what importance level below this one exists on the other systems, and so basically how much of that can I displace. If you look at the LPaaS 1 and LPaaS 2 in the left side of this chart, you'll see both of them have 500 service units that could be displaced because they are below level 2 where we're injecting new workload, obviously. But LPaaS 1 has more important workload than LPaaS 2, And that was not taken into consideration in the past. That will now be taken into consideration, so that when they have the same amount of displaceable capacity, we will choose the one that has the lowest importance level displaceable capacity, obviously. Similar thing when we're using zips and zaps. Again, there you could get into a situation where two LPARs are, you know, will look as if they were equal in terms of weights, where they really are not equal, because one of them might be sending some of the workload that was supposed to run on zaps or zip over to the general CP, so basically what we call crossover. And obviously we want to be able to go to the LPAR that has the least amount of crossover, because that's the one that best meets the type of workload that we are trying to dispatch to an LPAR within the SysBig. So two good enhancements in this area here, and hopefully it's going to be something that you will just observe that things are going to go a little bit better in terms of workload distribution. Page number 18, we're going to start look at scalability and performance items. There's a new API, and I don't think that's going to interest too many of you, but it is actually, if you are writing high-performance server programs, this API could provide some significant performance benefits. What it does is it basically explores the fact that almost all server programs, wherever a new connection, will call the accept socket call, will call the get sock name to find out which local IP address the client connect to, and then they will receive the transaction, if you will. That today takes three crossings down through the PFS layer and TCP/IP, and that with the new call is collapsed into a single API crossing, so basically reducing the amount of overhead to perform that type of operation. Page number 20 addresses a performance issue that typically has been seen with application programmers who typically are not familiar with the details of how the TCP layer works. Within TCP, there is an algorithm that some of us know better than we want to know. It's called the Nagel algorithm. It has a purpose. The problem is that an unknowing application programmer can actually run into scenarios where it's going to delay his transaction 200 milliseconds during startup. And the way to get around it is the application programmer sets a socket option that's called TCP no delay. But how many application programmers know that they need to do that? And they don't always need to do it. It depends a little bit on the application design if they need to do that. So it's kind of a tricky area, and we kind of given up trying to just document saying, go and do these things here. So instead, in release 11, we implement code that try and detect that we are in this situation here for the initial sequences of a new connection, and then we relax the requirements of those algorithms in that scenario. And just to give you a little example, we did run some internal testing with a badly written application that didn't do TCP no delay, and we were able to do about 3 transactions per second. With this new support within the TCP/IP stack, that went up to 2,600 transactions per second. Now, obviously, the transactions don't do a whole lot, but the point is this could have a significant impact on especially transactional workload. Where I have seen this all most often is in KickSockets applications, where the KickSockets programmers didn't really know what they needed to do in that area, and this certainly can help them a lot. Page 21, common storage and more virtual storage constraint relief. We are, in this release, moving a specific control block from ECSA and up into 64-bit common. It is a control block that exists for every single socket that is active on the system. And every socket requires about 384 bytes of ECSA storage today. So if you have a system with, 20,000 connections, you can do the math yourself. But there's quite a bit of ECSA storage that's used for that. That will, in release 11, reside in 64-bit common instead, and will basically buy you that ECSA relief. And again, it's not something you need to make any changes to do. It's just going to be there. Page 22 is another performance area where we try to address the issues of very long high latency networks. Think about a satellite link between Asia Pacific and Europe or the U.S., for example, and you every night are synchronizing databases between those two sites by transferring a large amount of bulk data between them. Even with the largest window sizes we have today, you cannot fill the pipe, if you will. So if I'm in this scenario that's in 64K out, well, when I've sent the last bit of those 64K out of the left system, well, the first bit of those 64K have not yet arrived on the right system. And not until they have all arrived can the right system begin to act that. So the point is, the pipe is sitting idle most of the time between those two systems. So in this release, we're implementing a technology that originally was defined by the Los Alamos National Laboratory called dynamic write sizing, which will recognize that a given workload is a streaming workload and that we are in this scenario, we are actually not filling the pipe. And we can figure that out by analyzing when the acts come in and things like that. And for that type of workload, we will dynamically allow the window size to grow up to 2 megabytes. You have no controls of this. It's just going to be done underneath the covers. And if the applications are not able to keep up with that, then we'll reduce the window size again. So it's kind of self-adjusting, if you will. This could have some significant enhancements in throughput over very long latency or very long and high latency networks. And I think some of you will benefit from this. Again, there's no configuration control. You can see that this is occurring through netstat commands by looking at the receive buffer size in the netstat.all command. They will actually see that those are very high. Another functional area that also affects performance is name resolution. Some of you have in the past configured a caching-only name server on ZOS to gain the performance benefits or not having to go out on the network for every resolver call. What we do here in release 11 is that we built such a cache into the system resolver address space. So you do no longer need to start a name server in caching-only mode to get the benefit of name caching on ZOS. This function is enabled by default on ZOS release 11. So if you don't have a caching-only name server today, you will get the benefits of one as soon as you start up release 11. If you do have a caching-only name server configuration today, you can leave it in place, or you can disable the resolver system cache, or you can disable the caching-only name server. You just need to figure out which of them you're going to use. We will recommend you use the system resolver cache. And the reason for that is on page 24. These are very preliminary performance data for the system resolver caching function. And if you just look at the number of resolver calls versus the CPU we use to process those, you will see that the resolver caching is actually more efficient than running a caching-only name server on the platform. So we want you to go there. If you are using caching-only name server today just for this purpose of performance, we really want you to go to use this new system resolver function in release 11. Yet another performance enhancement is something which we call the QDIO accelerator in release 11. Some of you might remember there was something called hypersocket accelerator at some point in time, which allowed us to push routing between QDIO and hypersockets down into the DLC layer. There were some limitations, right? You couldn't do QDIO to QDIO. You couldn't do hypersockets to hypersockets. It was mainly between QDIO and hypersockets and nothing else. And it didn't include suspicious distributor connection routing either. Now, this QDIO accelerator will accelerate between all combinations of QDIO, OSA Express, and hypersockets IQDIO network interfaces for all types of routing. And we'll talk a little bit more about suspicious distributor connection routing later on in this presentation here. Just as with hypersockets accelerator, you have to keep in mind that this cannot be done if you're using IP security. And the reason for that, obviously, is that all the filter rules and all the protection is implemented in the networking layer, and we need to come up into the networking layer to do your IP security, actually to try and meet your IP security policies. With QDIO accelerator, the packets do not come up into the networking layer. They are kept down at the data link control layer. This is enabled through an IP config configuration statement called QDIO accelerator, just as the old IQDIO routing was. and there are new NetStat route report variations to look at the routing tables that are pushed down into the DLC layer. Our QDO Accelerator brings us then to page 26, because what we do here is we actually exploit QDO Accelerator for SysPlex distributor connection routing also. And what that means is that when a connection comes into the SysPlex distributor on system 1, it will choose, for example, system 3 and send a connection over there. Inbound data from then on to that connection will be accelerated on system 1. So it will just loop around in the DLC layer. It will not go up through the IP networking layer on system 1. There's some prerequisites when that's going to happen, and it's not going to happen. But in general, I would say if you're using Viper route with a shared network, this will happen. Right? So there's some details around this we can talk about another time. But in general, Viper route over 1 gig Ethernet or 10 gig Ethernet, you will get the benefits of this support here. If you go to page 27, this is again one of those where we kind of stick our neck a little bit out and try and tell you a little bit about how we think this is going to impact your performance. What you can see there is that the minus 60-something bar there, that is the CPU savings on the distributing LPAR. So this will basically save you quite a bit of CPU cycles for doing this connection routing on the distributing LPAR. Based a little bit, are you going over hypersockets or are you going over a shared gigabit Ethernet? There's a little bit difference there. But this should actually be something, again, that will benefit every one of you who today use SysPlex Distributor. And again, quite a few of you do that in your environment today. Okay. One more SysPlex Distributor item I want to mention here is an enhancement to something we did a few years ago called Optimized Local Support. Optimized Local Support allowed two tiers, for example, an HTTP tier and an Enterprise Information Server tier, to keep the connection on the LPAR if in any way possible. Well, that was okay. But the point there was that when SysPlex Distributor for Tier 1 chose the LPAR for the Tier 1 connection, it only looked at the Tier 1 server instances. It did not look at the Tier 2 server instances on the same LPAR, because there's no way we could kind of group those together. In Release 11, we give you a way to group those two tiers together by giving them a logical name. In this scenario, I call them Group A. And that means that SysPlex Distributor, when it distributes a connection to the HTTP tier, will factor in the matrix, both for the HTTP tier and the EIS tier in this example here, on each LPAR it potentially can distribute the connection to. And the purpose of that is obviously to choose a good LPAR for both tiers, and by doing that, increasing the likelihood of staying on that LPAR with OptLocal being used between the two tiers afterwards. So reducing cross-LPAR traffic is what this is all about, obviously. Now, a nice enhancement to those of you who might use UpLocal. Okay, let's look at security. There's not so much to talk about security in this release here. We make some changes to the Internet Key daemon, where we are updating to some new standards in terms of how we do retransmissions and things like that. I wouldn't say significant, but there's a few things we did put in here. There are also some new attributes that we will report through the various network management interfaces, the IPsec command, NMI, and SMF records. I would call them relatively small changes, but to some of you it might be important. From an HTTLS point of view, we are in Release 11 picking up support for a number of new functions that System SSL either already had implemented or is implementing in ZOS Release 11. The intention is here to make ATTLS at par with System SSL in terms of capabilities, or basically being able to use all the System SSL capabilities, what it's about. That includes support for a new TLS protocol, version 1.1, a couple of other items that are a little bit obscure to me, but I'm sure they're important to some people. One thing that might be worth mentioning here is that System SSL is working on supporting what we call FIPS 140-2 compliance requirements, and ATTLS will in this release have a little checkbox when you define your definition for ATTLS that basically says must this SSL TLS implementation be compliant with FIPS 140-2? So if you check that little checkbox, it will be compliant with 140-2. The rest will be done for you is the whole point here. I also want to point out that many of those new enhancements in system SSL are being implemented in ATTLS only. We do not go back at this point in time, at least I don't think we will either, and change the application-specific SSL support in TN3270 and F2P. So if you want to take advantage of those new capabilities here, you need to start using ATTLS for TN3270 and FTP and other applications where you today might have a choice. Just want to point your attention to ATTLS is the environment that we will enhance the new functions for SSL in the future. That's an important message to get out. Simplification and consumability. Well, in this release, we did a rather large effort to try and make the whole policy-based networking infrastructure easier to manage and easier to both easier to set up and to administrate, obviously. This is just my high-level picture of what all this policy stuff is about, but this is, you know, about filtering and ATTLS and VPNs and all these good things we can do with policies today. Some of you have set some of it up, and some of you have not at this point in time. One of the elements of policy infrastructure is actually syslog daemon. Syslog daemon is used by other components that the policy infrastructure, but the policy infrastructure relies on syslog daemon for the auditing trail. If someone is trying to do an intrusion into your system, if someone is trying to send a packet into your system for which you have a filter rule that won't allow it, the spot that information is located is going to be is in syslog daemon, right? So syslog daemon becomes really important from an auditing point of view. So we shored up syslog daemon in this release and made it more robust and added a number of functions to it. First of all, we made sure that syslog daemon would be better in shape to deal with high message volumes by making it a multi-threaded implementation. It was early on a single task. In this release, every single destination you define in syslog daemon will run on its own thread within the syslog daemon address space. It will still continue to write to Unix files. We did not change that for various reasons, but what we did change was we built in an automatic archival function in syslog daemon that will take the active Unix files and archive them to MVS datasets, either just plain sequential datasets or GDD members or GDD new generations of GDD groups. That archive can be initiated by an operator command. It can be initiated by a specific time of day, or it can be initiated by a configuration option you enter that basically says keep an eye on the utilization of the underlying file systems that those Unix files reside in. And if that utilization goes above, let's say, 80%, then initiate an archive operation for the Unix files that are within that file system at that point in time. It also means that syslog daemon now supports a number of console modify commands. You no longer need to cancel syslog daemon to stop it. It's a major enhancement. You can now just use a p command to stop it. Another little thing you probably do need to be aware of here is that we also changed the way syslog daemon starts up. So where you use, for example, say start syslog d, and the resulting address space was syslog d1, that's no longer going to happen. When you start syslog d, the resulting address space will be syslog D, so it will be the name your procedure is in your DSL member. I know that's something you need to be aware of because you might have some automation in place that actually monitors syslog D1, and that actually now needs to begin monitoring syslog D instead, obviously. The final element we did around syslog daemon was that we added an ISPF-based search and browse interface that allows you to go and look at both the active log files and the archive log files. If you move to page 35, there's just a single of the many screenshots in that area. It just kind of shows you, after you have entered, you're given syslog d configuration file name, it will be parsed, and you will get a list here of all the destinations that write to Unix files. will tell you the start date and time of the first message in each of those files, and it will tell you if there are archive rules for it and how many archives are available at that point in time. An archive available, we basically mean, say, can we find them in the MVS catalog, the ZOS catalog? And you can for each of those, you can browse the active file, you can go into the archive files, you can search across active and archive files. So if you know something happened, but you don't exactly know if it is in the currently active file or in one of the last three archive files, for example, then you can initiate a search across both the active and the archive files. I didn't show the search panel here, but we can look more in detail at another point in time. Another thing we did in this area was that it's been a little bit difficult to use the TCP/IP autolog function to manage some of the policy infrastructure components. And that basically is caused by a couple of different reasons for that. One reason is that some of those components are LPAR-wide and not stack-specific. So if you have two stacks on an LPAR, which of the stacks should autolog what is one of the issues here. The other issue is that most of those components don't have a TCP listener, don't have a listening socket that you can actually do autolog monitoring on. So what we did in this release is that we enhanced policy agents to be the manager, if you will, of all those dependent address spaces. So it's a new set of configuration options for policy agents that, by the way, can be configured through the configuration assistant that will allow policy agent to start and monitor and stop all those dependent functions. So they will still be individual address spaces. You will still have JCL members for them, but policy agent will basically do the starting, the monitoring, and restarting in case some of them terminates. So the basic idea here is you use the configuration assistant to define just about everything. We pick up a couple of new configuration files, including the policy agent configuration files in release 11 also, and then you use policy agent to manage the whole infrastructure. That's the vision we're having with this infrastructure right now. One thing that's important for you over in Europe is that all the components here, the configuration file, the policy definition files, can now be encoded in the EBCD code pages other than 1047. I know that's been an issue because 1047, if you bring that up in your ISPF browser, all the square brackets and curly brackets look pretty nasty. And you can actually now instruct the configuration assistant to create those files in another EBCD code page as you might want to. Finally, one of the areas we ran into with the policy was that many of you came back and said, we need to be able to use some of the policy-related commands without necessarily having to log on to this ZOS Unix shell. PA certs, TRD stat, NSS control, and IPsec are all Unix system services commands only. So in this release, we implement an infrastructure that allows you to run those commands directly on the MVS console, in NetView, and in native TSO. And on the console and in NetView, we also added the Unix version of the ping command. So you can actually now do a ping command directly on the MVS console. The console implementation is based on system recs on ZOS. System recs in release 11 is enhanced to support Unix system services and system recs programs, which wasn't possible before release 11. So if any of you had tried to do anything with system recs and with some of those commands here, it really would not work until you got to release 11. Let's go to page 38. I'm not going to go into too much detail about the configuration assistant, but all the things I talked about here in policy infrastructure simplification is mirrored by new functions in the configuration assistant. The configuration assistant will also, in this release, if you, for example, say, I want to begin using IDS, for example, then it will take you through a list of what we call setup tasks in order to enable that specific, you know, discipline on a given LPAR. And that includes everything from giving you sample regex definitions, sample procedures, telling you to what you need to go and do now and upload this and upload that and start that and so on. So basically trying to takes your hand and leads you through all the things you need to look at in order to get those things done. Okay, we are getting into SNA and Enterprise Extender, and there are a couple of items in that area also. One requirement we had for a long time was that it was sometimes difficult to figure out which model application a given application would use when it opens its ACB, because you might have many different model definitions in your VTEM list members. So which one would actually be used? And it might not always be easy to figure out. So here we'll give you a new DNet models command and Apple, and you will specify the ACB name that your application is going to open later on. And then the command will actually tell you if that application is already active. But it will also tell you which model application statement is the best match for that application name you typed in, allowing you to actually figure out before you start that application to figure out which model application statement will be used to build that resource when you open the ACB. Page 41, High Performance Routing, Enterprise Extender. We have seen some performance issues with Enterprise Extender when the Enterprise Extender endpoint was on a distributed platform that was virtualized, for example, with VMware or something like that. In those environments, it's not uncommon to use various forms of time slicing, which means that a given operating system doesn't always have the adequate amount of CPU power available, which in an EE environment, due to the ARP algorithm, will immediately slow down. ARP will slow down as soon as there is a hiccup, if you will. In this release, we're implementing a new level of the ARP algorithm, which we call progressive mode ARP, that has a number of small changes that are all aimed at trying not to be so, not reacting so quickly to certain fluctuations in response times and round trip times with the partner platforms. Both partners must agree to use that progressive mode ARP for it to be used. And for the other, for V1R8, 9, and 10, there is an APAR you most likely will want to put on. I spoke with Sam Reynolds yesterday about that APAR, and if you don't have it on, things will still work, but you will drop down to base mode ARP, and you probably don't want to do that. So that's why you want to put that in. This APAR will not implement progressive mode ARP on those platforms, but it will avoid those platforms from dropping down into base mode ARP when they see someone trying to do progressive mode ARP with them. We are working with other vendors, and we expect that by the time release 11 comes out, the most commonly used distributed APPN EE software will have progressive mode ARP support in place also. Page 42 has a little bit to do with the same things. Pass switches, sometimes, again, hiccups can cause us to go into pass switch. And if it indeed was a very short hiccup, what's going to happen is we're just going to pass switch to the same route again, right, which is totally a waste of resources. So there are certain scenarios where you might want to say, I really don't want you to pass switch until at least this time has occurred. Right? And you can now put a new start option into VTEM called HPR pass switch delay and specify the minimum amount of time before a pass switch should be started. And it's all about trying to reduce the amount of unproductive pass switches that might occur, obviously. Finally, in SNA, or not finally, but almost finally in SNA, there is a concept some of you have probably met, not very nice. It's called a TDU, or Topology Database Update War, where a couple of APPN nodes basically fight with each other about who knows best about the state of a given resource. And such a war can go on for a very, very long period of time, and it can impact other APPN nodes in the network. So this little example here on page 43, CP4 and 5 are in war with each other, and that's going to impact performance all the way over in CP1 because he's going to receive copies of all those TDU updates. The problem for CP1 is he has no clue of who's engaged in this war. He can just see that things are going bad, but he doesn't know where the problem is. So what we're doing in this release is to include a new control vector in this TDU update that allows a node within the APPN network to figure out where did this TDU update originate. So you can go back and figure out, you know, it's one of those two guys over here that right now is in war, and then hopefully figure out a way to solve that. Now, doing that, there's a little bit other change we're making also, because there was an old rule that said if any partners in the APPN network didn't understand a certain control vector, a new control vector, then we wouldn't send it to anyone, right? Well, but with the number of new control vectors that have been implemented over the last few years, there are a couple of old systems, especially BN Vitam and BSE Vitam, that don't understand those control vectors. So if you had those systems in your network, you're not going to use those control vectors at all when we talk with any of our neighboring partners. We will change that in release 11, so we will just not use them talking to the specific nodes that don't understand them, but we will use them talking to other nodes that do understand them. Page 44, another ECSA relief has to do with the RTP control block, Rapid Transport Protocol control blocks, where we basically move, I think it was about a 2 kilobyte control block per RTP, and we move about half of that into private storage. There's still going to be some of it in ECSA, but about half of each of those will be moved into private storage. So again, based on the number of pipes you have on a given system, you should see some improvements in that area also stemming from this change here. Additional EESNA enhancement on page 45, there are some performance enhancements we're implementing for enterprise extender traffic over IPsec. EE has caused us a little bit of a headache sometimes with IPsec. It kind of works where we are today, but there are some scenarios where it doesn't work as well as we want it to work. So we are doing a couple of things in release 11 to improve how EE works over IPsec, including enabling that workload to better match the SIP processing technology. Everything wouldn't go down to the SIP in the current implementation. And finally, for those of you who no longer have an NCP but still want to be able to use ACF TAP to format VTAM buffer traces, there's good news. ACF TAP will in release 11 be part of communication server. It's not going to cost you anything extra. It's just going to be in the TCP IP load libraries, and you can run your normal ACF TAP jobs plus pointing to those libraries instead of the SSP libraries in release 11. Virtualization, page 47. As you may remember, the QDO architecture actually supports 4 priority outbound queues. And unless you set up QoS policies on your LPAR, well, those queues aren't really used for anything. Everything goes to a single queue. So what we did in this release was we said, well, let's find a way to use those priority queues without necessarily setting up QoS. We still recommend setting up QoS, but if you don't do that, we will in this release take the workload manager importance level of the application that is sending the data and map that to one of the 4 priority queues. There's a default mapping, or you can change the mapping in the WLM priority queue statement in the TCP IP profile. As you know, there are 8 importance class levels defined by workload manager, and you will basically take those 8 classes and map them to one of the 4 queues, or as you might want to do that, and then we will just basically use the priority queues based on that. 48, OSA interface isolation. It's a mechanism where we allow you to configure that you will not allow 2 LPARs to just loop back through an OSA adapter. There are some scenarios where you install router or filters in your routers, access rules in your routers, and if LPAR 1 is routing to LPAR 2 but just looping back through the OSA adapter, well, those filters are not applied to that traffic. And there have been some scenarios where customers said, we must make absolutely sure that all packets are inspected by the filters we have out in our router environment. And for that purpose, it is now possible to configure something called isolate that basically says this network interface cannot loop back through the OSA adapter to another LPAR. It's not allowed. Right? Some things you need to be careful with that. That is, if you're actually sharing a subnet with OP route and things like that between the two LPARs, you don't want to use isolate, but that's another story. Page 50, network management interfaces. The dynamic Viper MIP, which we have had for a couple of years, we have re-implemented that, if you will, as an NMI interface. And that have really had to do with performance. Especially NetView, we're using that, and it requires quite a bit of CPU cycles to go and get all that dynamic Viper MIP information out. And this is going to make it much less overhead to do the same thing. There's a new NMI interface that allows an NMI application to retrieve configuration information from the TCP/IP profile. That will also be written in SMF records, and it will be warnings when, or there will be SMF records written when someone actually does an obey file. The whole purpose with this is to enable auditing software to keep track of what has changed in the TCP/IP profile at what point in time and by what means is what that's all about. OSA network traffic analyzer data is the OSA NTA trace that can now be set up through the NMI interface also, plus then we've got some new or detailed CSM usage through NMI interface. Page 51 is a small enhancement to the ZOS ping command that makes it look very much like other platforms. We call it the verbose option, but if you do a ping on Windows, for example, it looks different than what ping does on ZOS today. So this change basically makes it look more or less as it does on other platforms. Just a few words about some statement of directions. RFC 4301 compliance. There was a change in release 10 where we upgraded to a new RFC level for IPsec. And some of your IP filter rules may need to be changed to be in compliance with RFC 4301. We will give you probably until the release after release 11 to get that compliance, to get those compliance changes in if you have IPsec filter rules today. So just keep that in mind. The configuration system will actually help you do that, so it's not a terrible big thing. The other one is, the one on page 53 has actually caused a little bit of feedback from a number of customers already, so let me just explain that a little bit. We issued this statement direction saying that we actually will in a future release remove the name server function totally from ZOS. And the idea there was that with release 11, we now have the caching being part of the system resolver. So those of you who ran a name server just for caching purposes really don't need it any longer. And it was our belief that the number of customers who ran DNS bind for purposes other than caching only, basically as primary or secondary name server, was extremely low. I think I am about 2 minutes over time, so I'm not going to talk to the summary. The summary page is just kind of a glorified picture of everything the communication server does. But you can look at that yourself. So I'm gonna end this here and turn it back to Arnie, who needs to get the...
Okay, thank you, Alfred.